English settlement in America began as early as 1585 with an unsuccessful colony in what is now North Carolina. The first successful English colony in America was founded at Jamestown, Virginia, in 1607. But the first successful English settlement in New England came in 1620, when an English group, now called the Pilgrims, disembarked from the Mayflower in Wampanoag Territory.
When the Mayflower came into Plymouth, an animal with wings came unto us. And when it spoke, it made a noise like thunder, and smoke and fire came out of its mouth, and it would swallow all the Indians up.
The place where the English landed was the home of the Wampanoag and Norset Indians, and the Wampanoag still live there today. Their name translates to mean people of the first light. 10 years later, a second English group established the Massachusetts Bay Colony a few miles up the coast at a place they called Boston. Members of the two groups came from several diverse areas of the British Isles and Holland. Although many were English Puritans who came for religious reasons, others represented diverse interests and came for many different reasons.
The Europeans came to America for one reason, and everything else was subordinate to that. They came here to take the place, to take the land, and after they got well established and strong enough, to take the people too.
Welcome to The Literary Hangover. I am your host, Matt Leck. I'm riding solo today, and this is going to be a bit of a different kind of episode. It's going to be sort of a compilation of different media that I've used to inform myself about what's been historically known as the Pequot War, but which is probably more accurately described as the Mystic Massacre and subsequent mop-up operations by the Massachusetts Bay Colony and colonial allies, some including Native American tribes like the Narragansetts. We're going to get deep into this. This is a sort of supplement to Hope Leslie, which, as patrons will know, thank you, patrons, I am narrating my own audiobook of Hope Leslie by Catherine Maria Sedgwick. It includes a discussion of this Mystic Massacre. That's actually a main plot point. It happens before the start of the book, but it's retold by Magawiska, one of the main characters. The more I learned about this incident in history, the more I realized that it wouldn't be something that I'd want to try to cover in an episode where we're also talking about a rather long novel. I wanted to kind of go through just the history of this for people, because I think this massacre and really what led to it, the different sort of trade and political and demographic conflicts and forces sort of sets the table for a lot of conflict that will come later in America, particularly this is one of the early instances of white identity politics trumping any other form of identity politics. The Narragansetts and Pequots were not able to come together and were instead divided and conquered eventually. But I don't want to get ahead of myself. What you just heard at the start of this show was a portion of Mystic Voices, the story of the Pequot War, which is a 2005 documentary, and it's now available on YouTube. And I found it really helpful, and I'm going to be going back to that a bit more during this recording. I am going to be relying heavily on sources for this. On Literary Hangover, we're going to be staking out the widest liberties when it comes to fair use, which is going to, in this instance, involve a couple of documentaries that are uploaded on YouTube, as I mentioned, a couple of academic articles that I found very useful, and a few different books that are available on Audible that I'm going to be playing clips from as well. So basically, we need to tell the story of the Pequot Indians. And I first heard of them in the context of Moby Dick, actually. The Pequot is the name of the boat, of Ahab's boat. And it's important to note right off the bat that Pequot Indians, or Native Americans, indigenous people, they're still around and actually have had something of a resurgence since the 70s. In Connecticut, this is, I should also point out. The Thames River, if you look at a map and you find the Thames River, that used to be called the Pequot River, and we will go into why the name was changed, you can probably guess. What I've learned about the Pequot Indians at this time is we're looking at the 1630s here. And you have Dutch New York and you have the English Massachusetts area. And they're both have their eyes on Connecticut. And you also have Rhode Island in, which is more of a Puritan skeptical area, obviously, and which led by Roger Williams was ally of the Narragansett Indians, who will come into play here. And the Pequot Indians really had that area locked down. They weren't as affected by earlier smallpox and diseases that decimated nearby tribes. And as we know, smallpox preceded an awful lot of American colonialism, wiping out 9 out of 10 Native Americans in a lot of different tribes. Because they weren't ready for the diseases that had been brewing and becoming immunized against but on the Eurasian African continents. Here's a little bit of that.
Lacking adequate resistance to diseases brought by Europeans, northeastern native peoples suffered two major epidemics in the early 17th century. The Puritan colonies at Plymouth and Massachusetts Bay were established on Indian settlements depopulated by a great epidemic that had swept through the Algonquian tribes between 1616 and 1619. The epidemic killed about 90% of the native inhabitants along the coast of New England, but did not reach either the Pequots or the Niantic and Narragansett neighbors. In 1633, a second epidemic caused by smallpox did not spare any of the tribes.
The Pequots were the strongest tribe in the Connecticut River Valley, and that was not a tenable position for a long time. And we're going to get into why. It's basically a confluence of issues to do with trade. We're going to get into wampum. We're going to get into seaways a little bit. Let's return to the Mystic Voices documentary for a look at why the strength of the Pequots was not exactly a long-term tenable position with their new neighbors from Europe.
In 1537, Pope Paul III, in his bull, Sublimus Deus, had proclaimed that American Indians were rational beings with souls and that their rights and properties should be protected. Paul's decree became a part of the international law of the day. The decree, along with other European concepts, defined the legal ways Puritans could obtain land from the natives. Any taking of native land had to be justified under four legal principles: purchase, patent, possession, and the right of conquest. Outright purchase of native land was not uncommon in Puritan New England, but at first, natives did not fully understand that purchase by Europeans meant giving up their land forever. The right of patent gave a Christian monarch authority over all non-Christian lands discovered in that monarch's name. Although seen as unchristian by many in their congregation, under English law, the Puritans had every right to dispossess the heathen natives. Roger Williams was one member of the Puritan Church who disagreed with the right of patent.
"We have not our land by patent from the king, but that the natives are the true owners of it, and that we ought to repent of such a receiving it by patent."
For these and other radical ideas, Williams was expelled from the Massachusetts Bay Colony in the winter of 1635.
"Be fruitful and multiply, and replenish the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over every living thing that moveth upon it."
To the Puritans, the Book of Genesis had commanded God's people to dominate the earth. The right of possession was based on this and other Old Testament citations. Many Puritans believed that land not being used by those they saw as the heathen was open to any Puritans who would make use of it. On this ground, the Puritans based their concept of vacuum domicilium.
The Puritans, like other English colonists and other European colonists from other nations, assumed that the patent from the crown was sufficient justification for creating settlements and then acquiring land directly from the natives, or perhaps occupying land that was, in their opinion, vacuum domicilium, that is to say, open land not occupied or used adequately by the natives. When the settlers got to America, they found that in many cases the land was far more used than they had expected, and purchase and later conquest became the principal means of acquisition.
Vacuum domicilium would be, if I was making vocabulary list for this, that would be definitely on your list of vocabulary terms. Because when you realize and you read more about this, you realize that a lot of the areas that they settled, and settled isn't exactly the right term, but Native Americans were seasonal people that had different foodstuffs for different types of the season. Wherever you can get the food, you would go. But often you would return because seasons are cyclical. So you're going to return cyclically to certain parts of Connecticut and these river valleys, because those river valleys, you don't just settle arbitrarily wherever you think and then try to find food there. You settle where the resources were. And the Pequods were especially vulnerable to this because of where they were.
Years before the English landed, the Dutch had established a lucrative fur trade in New Netherland and New England. Beaver furs, which were abundant in early 17th century America, were in great demand to make stylish hats in Europe. To make the fur trade work, the Dutch had learned to deal in wampum. They discovered early that coastal tribes would trade wampum for European goods. The Dutch used wampum to trade for furs with the inland tribes. Control of access to the wampum meant control of the fur trade. In the early 1630s, the Pequots and tributary tribes under them controlled the wampum supply and enjoyed a virtual trade monopoly in their territory.
When European people came over here, they were already living in a cash economy, and they were looking to see a way of connecting with Native people. And how could they connect with Native people? How could they trade with Native people if they didn't have money? It was so interesting that when the Dutch arrived here, and also seeking the same thing, they even set up a factory to produce wampum. And so they called it money.
Furs, beaver furs in particular, were what Europeans were seeking. And within a few years after European contact, the beavers in southern New England and along Long Island Sound were gone.
Now, wampum is something I really want to focus in on, and as well as beaver fur, as early forms of currency, really. And I'd be curious if there's anyone who's written on this specifically from a Marxist standpoint, and sort of primitive accumulation. But that detail of the Dutch creating wampum machines, we'll go into a little bit how wampum is created. But that is an early currency, and the reason the territory the Pequots were on was so valuable is because it had access to shells that were used to sand down and make into these into wampum. Here's a little bit more on this Mystic Voices documentary on wampum specifically.
On Long Island and along the New England coast, they depended on shellfish for food. They polished the seashells into beads and strung them into strands, belts, and sashes called wampum. To the Algonquin, wampum had and continues to have great spiritual value.
Wampum comes from a quahog shell. The purple is made from the quahog, and the white is formed from the whelk. And both these are created into beads that were strung together, or sometimes just worn. To me, wampum means something very special. Wampum means something very sacred. And I find it very interesting that history books are teaching children that wampum means money. Wampum to Native people never meant money. Before European people arrived here, wampum had a different meaning, a different significance. It was used in ceremonies. It was used to seal contracts. So when Native people made an agreement and they said, "This is the way it shall be, and I'm giving my word," they sealed it with a string of wampum.
Yeah, so I find the concept of wampum to be something that I just fascinating and something I really want to monitor over the course of this project. I have a few academic sources that get into it a little bit that I'd like to share with you. The first being by Catherine Grandjean in the William and Mary Quarterly in January 2011. It's called New World Tempests, Environment, Scarcity, and the Coming of the Pequot War. Thank you to Daniel Buck, who helped me get access to this through JSTOR. It goes into the different sort of environmental factors that led to the Pequot, the massacre of the Pequots, including hurricanes and food shortages. But let's focus on what it says about wampum here. First, it makes a note, and this isn't the New England colonists, this is in Virginia, which I'm less read up on, but she notes that The English in Virginia, for instance, brought great sheets of copper that they can cut into pendants and jewelry and give to the Powhatans, often in return for corn. So once again, they figure out the currency that the Native Americans are trading in and come over with industrialized ways of making lots of it. Later, Grandjean writes, the Pequots were indeed powerful, situated along the northern shore of Long Island Sound, mostly to the east of the Pequot, later Thames River. They had recently enjoyed a period of great power coinciding with the advent of native European trade. The waters that eventually claimed Oldham's body, Oldham is a trader that was killed in a sort of precipitating event, or, well, not precipitating, an event that was used to attack the Pequots, Turner Joy, Gulf of Tonkin sort of thing. The waters that eventually claimed Oldham's body lay at the nexus of complex trading spheres, where Dutch, English, and native interests overlapped. Though they had recently fallen out with Dutch traders, the Pequots largely dictated trade terms in the region. Living along a coast whose shore brimmed with quahog shells, they enjoyed a great measure of control over the making and trading of wampum, the white and purple beads so prized by Dutch Indians. Now, that's a very interesting section to me, because basically the Pequots had taken the territory that had the money supply, if you want to use, or a money supply, because, of course, as we said, beaver pelts, and as we'll find out, corn were also forms of currency. But the most pure form was this symbolic wampum, which was also used to tell stories. And it wasn't, to think of it as money, as we've heard a little bit, is a bit vulgar. Another article on the murder of John Oldham is called Murder on the Saltwater Frontier by Andrew C. Lippman in Early American Studies, an Interdisciplinary Journal, spring 2011. And that also had some interesting things to say about wampum and its relevance to the why the Pequots were singled out by the colonists. Lippman writes, for Indians, this coast took on a new importance at the same time. Increasingly, Algonquins moved their villages shoreward to be closer to foreign traders hawking cloth and tools. Crowding near shellfish banks also brought Indians closer to the raw material for minting wampum beads, the shared currency for intercultural trade in the Northeast. As a place where rival native cultural powers converged in search of trade and territorial gains, the coastal setting of Oldham's murder was filled with hidden currents as menacing as the darkest alleys of any film noir. Later, again, John Oldham, who was murdered, not by Pequots, as you would expect, because it was a quote-unquote precipitating event of the Pequot War, but by Narragansetts. Oldham and his Narragansett, this is what it says later in this Lippman, Oldham, his Narragansett pilots, and his Manissas assassins were all major players in a bustling coastal trade in furs, goods, and grain that was facilitated by an intercultural currency of shell beads that the English called wampum and the Dutch called zeewan. Those small white and purple shell cylinders were a major lure in drawing Oldham to Block Island on that windy day, as was Indian corn. The English colonies in the region could produce only meager grain harvests, and their very survival depended on local Indians' willingness to sell their surplus maize. Now, I wanted to go to this video put up by Boston Children Museum in December of 2015 with a native educator in Mashpee Wampanoag, Anawan Whedon. He explains the significance and importance of wampum. I thought this was a good video.
The quahog itself, it's got a purplish inside to the shell. The outer bark, as we call it, of the shell is fairly white in complexion. The purple part is what we call the soup quahog, and that was the dark shell clam. Quahog being the word that derives from our traditional word for this material here. Soup quahog is where you get the word quahog. So that actually describes the purple part. Wampum beak, as the word wampum derives from, was usually referring to the white part of the beak. Not only can you use the white part of the quahog shell, but often the whelk, the inner core of the whelk and conch shells, the spiral center, were also used to make those white beads. So the actual wampum would often be the white bead. The soup quahog is what you're looking at today. The purple part, this piece here, shows you really good the veins that flow through, also showing the age of the quahog. But yeah, this word, quahog, comes from our word sulquahog, and that's what we use to describe this dark shell. Some say the purple was more valuable than the white. A lot of Europeans, and even some modern contemporary Americans today, historians and whatnot, they all refer to one of them in a form of currency. It was never considered money. It was always valuable. When you take a resource from the ocean, not only are you able to nourish your body with it and your family most likely, but to turn a brittle shell such as this into small, intricate beads, beads that were often assembled into long strands before they were given to their chief. A chief would not really be able to do much with just one or two beads, so you would have to give at least an entire strand of these wampum beads to your leader. When you gave them to the leader would then take them and transform them into a belt, a sash, possibly headband, bracelets, armbands of different sorts, all of which illustrate his people's history. So when you think of the Bible, when you think of the Constitution, these are valuable documents that people keep in secured areas. The climate of those rooms has to be monitored because they don't want to degrade the quality of these documents. Well, our wampum belts are the very same documentation of our history. We didn't write our words down, we illustrated our stories with the designs and the patterns that were made once we assembled the small beads made from this quahog shell. So when you want to put a value to the wampum, it's easily done, but you have to think of the time and effort that it took using the tools at the time that were available to make something so brittle into a very shiny, tubular, almost perfectly round bead. And then, of course, you have to drill the center of that bead out. And that's just one bead. You have to make many of these, as I said, before you can even give them to your leader, before they can actually use them in a manner to illustrate their people's history.
Now, that is amazing to me. There's a characteristic American thing where we try to do something faster and cheaper, and in the process lose something about it. The way the Dutch had machines to create these beads, take something away from those beads, right? I've often thought of this when I am looking at architecture, and I was in Paris earlier this year, luckily enough, and looking at that architecture versus looking at new giant skyscraper towers that have clearly benefited from, hundreds of years of project managers finding out ways to cut laborers out of it and make things cheaper. And so you have these amazingly old brick structures, for instance, that have been there for hundreds and hundreds of years versus a giant steel tower that, I think the novelty is slowly wearing off of these giant towers, and you realize that what makes something beautiful like Versailles isn't that monarchy was there, but that it took a whole bunch of time to build and attention to build. It's disgusting that that amount of attention goes to private monarchy, but what was amazing about it is the human effort that went into it. And if you could just make one of those by planting a seed with some special new device or something, I don't know what I'm trying to say, but let's continue. So let's skip ahead to where the Pequot War the rubber hits the road here. Here's a book called God, War, and Providence: The Epic Struggle of Roger Williams and the Narragansett Indians Against the Puritans of New England. I found this to be an exceptional book. It came out in June 12th, 2018. That's recent enough to maybe we should have this guy on Majority Report. It's mainly about Roger Williams and the Narragansett Indians, but there's a great chapter on the Pequot War, or the Mystic Massacre, and the Massacre of the Pequots, basically genocide. This is the first genocide of New England, it would be one way to put it. This is how it describes the coming of the Pequot War.
In the early 1630s, the Narragansetts found themselves engaged in on-again, off-again warfare with their perennial enemies to the west, the Pequots, for the loyalty and tribute of the small bands of Indians who lived on the Connecticut River, and for control over the land between the Pocketuck and the Thames Rivers. These Narragansett-Pequot clashes were part of a larger regional conflict that drew in a small number of Dutchmen hunkered down at a trading post near modern Hartford, English traders from Plymouth Plantation, several hundred settlers from Massachusetts Bay intent on establishing a new colony on the Connecticut River, and the Pequot's disaffected kindred tribe, the Mohegans, led by Uncas. That wily sachem was then busily poaching bands from the Pequot sachem to Tobin's orbit, having failed to gain the Pequot sachemship for himself, despite several spirited attempts. The Pequot's attacks on the river tribes that had formerly been their tributaries forced those Indians to seek protection from either the Narragansetts or the Mohegans, both of whom took to the warpath against the Pequots. In early 1634, the Pequots killed several members of a Narragansett party attempting to trade with the Dutch at their trading post. Eager to preserve their highly profitable trade relationship with the Narragansetts, the Dutch responded swiftly. They captured Totobem and held him for ransom. A ransom was paid by the Pequots, but a bit too late. The Dutch handed over Totobem's corpse rather than the man. The Pequot reaction to the killing of Totobem was measured, revealing the weakness of their strategic position in the volatile Connecticut River Valley. A Pequot raiding party boarded a ship at the mouth of the Connecticut River and killed its captain. Unfortunately, the ship was not Dutch, nor was the captain. The Pequots had killed Captain John Stone, a rogue English trader pirate who had led a colorful criminal career in New England and the West Indies. He had stolen a sailing vessel in Plymouth and been booted out of Massachusetts for suspected adultery, among a host of other offenses. Having killed an Englishman, even a rogue Englishman, the Pequots would be expected to answer for doing so before trade with the English could resume. Finding themselves in active conflict with the Narragansetts, the Dutch and the Mohegans simultaneously, and now facing trouble with the English, the Pequots were in a real bind. As John Winthrop reported in his journal at the time, the Pequots could not trade safely anywhere. Now, let the listener beware. The many gaping holes in the evidence and problems in sorting out the exact chronology of events prevent us from uncovering the intentions of the Bay Colony and Connecticut regarding the Pequots in the impending war with anything like certainty. All of the historians writing in the years immediately after the Pequot's fate was sealed, and for three centuries after that, accepted pretty much uncritically the intentions the Puritans ascribed to themselves in their written recollections. Both participants and chroniclers present the two Puritan colonial governments in Boston and in Hartford as fair-minded arbitrators in a series of messy disputes among Indian peoples and European traders, and as defenders of peace and order. The Pequots are depicted as bellicose expansionists who had to be challenged to restore peace along a roiling frontier. After the Pequots repeatedly failed to make reasonable compensation to the English for a series of criminal acts, including the murder of Stone and conspiring with other Indians to slaughter English people on the Connecticut River, the Puritans were left with no choice but to attack the warmongers and destroy them as an independent tribe. Since the mid-1970s, historians have carefully re-examined the fragmentary documentary record and the contemporary histories. Their work has hardly clarified definitively the tangle of motives and intentions of the participants, but they have succeeded in demolishing the conventional view of the war that persisted for hundreds of years. Recent accounts of the conflict differ on the exact sequence of events and many details, but they all reach the same broad conclusion. The Puritan arbitrators in Boston and on the Connecticut River were neither disinterested nor fair-minded in working out a solution to the crisis with the Pequots. Wilcome Washburn, a judicious scholar of Puritan-Indian relations, if ever there was one, puts it this way. While it is dangerous to reason from assumed motives of the participants, it is fair to assert that both the established colony of Massachusetts and the newer colony of Connecticut sought to profit from the destruction of this powerful tribe. The causes of the war given by the contemporary English seem strained and arbitrary. Strained and arbitrary is putting it mildly. Moreover, the Pequots, without question, made a sustained good-faith effort to appease the English for any offenses they had committed, inadvertent or otherwise, in the interest of re-establishing amicable relations. The English responded to Pequot peace overtures with both words and actions clearly designed to provoke war rather than secure peace. Why? The answer is plain enough. The English believed it was both their right and destiny to establish control over eastern Connecticut, with a view to establishing a powerful new Puritan colony there. To that end, the English bullied the Pequots into submission, with the help of their Indian rivals, under the guise of restoring order and obtaining justice.
This is what's interesting about this Pequot War, is the false justifications for it. Now, I want to go back to the academic papers here just for a second, to go a bit slower over the death of Oldham and Stone, the two traitors that were killed and used by the Puritans as an excuse to start this war first. In Catherine Graham Jean's New World Tempest, she writes, "For the English, the Pequot War began with several English traitors' deaths. Though John Oldham's death became the most notorious incident, it was not the first. It recalled other attacks, including one that had happened 2 years earlier in 1634. That summer, another English trader, Captain John Stone, had been slain, apparently by Pequot tributaries. He had coerced these Indians to go as pilots with two of his crewmen toward Dutch colonies. But before the cohort had departed, the two Englishmen, quote, were both murdered by their Indian guides. Stone, quote, asleep in his cabin, end quote, was slain next, followed by the rest of his crew, seven men in all. The Indian pilots, according to a latter account, then heedlessly plundered what they pleased and sunk the bark. More recently, yet another English trader, William Hammond, had fallen prey to Indians on the shores of Long Island. When colonial historians took up their pens to explain the coming of the war, nearly all pointed first to these incidents. John Mason opened his brief history of the Pequot War with the scene of Stone's crew being, quote, murdered, and John Underhill cited the, quote, taking away the life of one Master John Oldham as a critical spark. William Bradford, too, identified John Oldham's death as, quote, one ground of the Pequot War. And in fact, in the wake of discovery, the colonies stirred to war. Barely a month after Oldham perished, soldiers from Massachusetts and Connecticut ran roughshod over Block Island and Pequot villages. Now, the other article I have here, Murder on the Saltwater Frontier by Andrew Littman, goes into a bit of the differences between John Oldham, the death of Oldham and Stone, for the key differences and why the Oldham death being used as justification to massacre Pequots is exceedingly tough to believe. Colonial apologists for the Pequot War would later lump the Stone incident with the Oldham affair, despite the fact there were serious differences between the two slayings. The major problem behind the Puritan decision to blur the crimes together was that the Pequot's hands were conspicuously clean of Oldham's blood. I should just describe. Oldham was basically off of Block Island, island off of Long Island, between Long Island and Connecticut, sort of, Long Island and Rhode Island. And some Native American, he was found dead by another English sailor, and with his head cleaved to the brains and sort of dismembered. And the suggestion is that the Narragansett Indians that were with him were upset, and maybe they had a larger group conspiracy, but at least maybe a few sachems or at least a couple of groups of Narragansett allied Native Americans killed Oldham because he was growing too close to the Pequots. And the Pequots and Narragansetts were, the Narragansetts were more Puritan affiliated.
The English feared for their survival in what they saw as the wilderness of America. The Powhatan uprising in Virginia in 1622 had reinforced these fears. The stories they heard from most of the native tribes in the region, many of which had been subjugated by the Pequots, in their mind clearly showed that the Pequots were powerful, hostile, and devious. These perceptions, along with the killing of Captain Stone, fueled the growing hostility toward the Pequots.
Look at the Pequots and all other Indians as a common enemy, who, though he may take his occasion of the beginning of his rage from one part of the English, yet if he prevail, will surely pursue his advantage to the rooting out of the whole nation.
Within a month of the Saybrook Conference, another death transforms the situation. Members of Narragansett Tributary Tribe on Block Island kill Captain John Oldham. The motives for Oldham's killing are unclear.
John Oldham, now being an inhabitant of the Massachusetts, went with a small vessel and slenderly manned a trading among the Indians, and upon some quarrel they knocked him in the head with a hatchet, so as he fell down dead and never spake word more.
John Gallup, coming from Connecticut in a bark, espied a small pinnace, which drawing near unto, they found to be Mr. Oldham's. So they hailed him, but had no answer. They boarded her, and looking about, they found John Oldham under an old sen, stark naked, his head cleft to the brains, and his hand and legs cut, as if they had been cutting them off, and yet warm.
And this I return to Littman. The major problem between the Puritan decision to blur the crimes together was that the Pequot's hands were conspicuously clean of Oldham's blood. The colonial vilification of the Pequots becomes even more suspect when one considers that Stone was not, like Oldham, a local man with established relationships with both Indians and colonists in the region. Instead, he was a reckless intruder, a Virginian whose final voyage up the Connecticut was the last episode of an epic booze-soaked rampage up and down the eastern seaboard. Months before the Pequots bludgeoned him to death, Stone had narrowly escaped being hanged for his drunken attempt at piracy in Manhattan and for his drunken attempt at adultery in Boston, and both the Dutch and English had banished him from their ports. The obvious question lingering about Stone's death is not why did the Pequots kill him, but rather why a wronged sea captain, an almost cuckolded husband, or a colonial executioner failed to kill the rogue first. But that really didn't matter, obviously. And later Lippmann writes, "Examining Oldham's murder serves as a reminder that the English chose to go to war with the Pequots, just as they easily could have chosen to go to war with the Narragansetts. But the fact that the Puritans had to choose also demonstrates their comparative weakness. Colonists could not risk a war with two sizable Indian powers at the same time, and it did not make sense to pick a fight with the smaller of the two. The Pequots had more villages, more wampum, more corn, and more enemies than the Narragansetts, and they sat on a more strategic location at the mouth of Long Island Sound and near the mouth of the Connecticut, making them a particularly tempting target. War with the Pequots would help the English extinguish the Dutch West India Company's easterly claims in a way that war with the Narragansetts would not. To pull off this cynical conquest, Jennings and other argues, Puritans willingly forgot the true details of Oldham's murder while feigning anger over the death of the hated drunkard and pirate John Stone." And that pattern is something that is going to be replicated over and over in American history. We invaded Afghanistan after a bunch of hijackers from Saudi Arabia and other Middle Eastern countries, not Afghanistan, flew a plane into the World Trade Center, another trade target. And, you know, Oldham's death, as a New World Tempest points out, was very stressful for the entire economy because he traded corn. That was a huge, huge commodity at the time because people literally starved to death. Well, not in New England, but they were hungry. The soldiers were hungry as they massacred the Mystics. And we'll get to the massacre shortly. As Grandjean writes in New World Tempests, even in bountiful times, coastal traders were often the ones to procure and supply food. Newer settlements often looked to add to their own meager harvests by trading with more established English towns or with Indians. Men such as Oldham, therefore, had a special role to play in transporting precious goods to places in need. Plymouth and Massachusetts had relied on purchases of Indian corn, the latter using Oldham as an intermediary. As a trader, he had brokered for corn when necessary from Indian neighbors. On at least one occasion, he had helped feed Massachusetts Bay, where in 1634, the Rebecca unloaded 500 BZ of corn given to Mr. Oldham by the Narragansetts. After his death, the Connecticut government's first concern was with Oldham's stock of corn. Even as they dealt with escalating tensions with the Pequots, magistrates carefully appointed men to look to and pursue the corn of Mr. Oldham and bring an account to next court of what quantity there is of it. Here's a bit more from God Warm Providence.
"Tensions in the Pequots and between the Pequots and the Narragansetts were by all accounts peaceable throughout 1635 and early 1636. By the end of 1635, several hundred Puritans had settled at the mouth of the Connecticut River at Fort Saybrook, as well as at a handful of locations upriver, notably at Windsor and Wethersfield, where they were warmly welcomed by the Pequots and their tributaries. The Puritans clearly wanted to expand their limited settlements near the river substantially, as the land in the valley was far more fertile than the land around Boston, and the fur trade in the valley was bustling. The Connecticut River Valley was seen by the oligarchy as an ideal place for immediate expansion, not least because of what Winthrop described as the fruitfulness and commodiousness of Connecticut and the danger of having it possessed by others, Dutch or English. Before too long, Sassacus did make a substantial wampum payment to Massachusetts, along with some other gifts, as a sign of the Pequots' honorable and friendly intentions."
Here in God Warn Providence, we get a little bit more into the run-up to the massacre.
In November 1634, Pequot emissaries had arrived in Boston seeking to reestablish trade relations with Massachusetts, sort out the issue of Captain Stone, and gain Massachusetts' assistance in brokering a peace agreement with the Narragansetts. In exchange, the Pequots indicated they would happily welcome English settlement within their territory. They would also pay tribute to the English for their services in restoring peace, for this was how all such arrangements were made between different Indian groups in the region long before the Puritans had arrived on the scene. The draft treaty proposed by the English was decidedly lopsided. The ordinarily meticulous record keepers of the Bay Colony, or their descendants, somehow lost all the copies of the text, leading more than one contemporary investigator to question whether the document was more of a Puritan ultimatum than a viable draft agreement, and thus best not viewed by the prying eyes of posterity. Massachusetts Bay agreed to establish trade relations with the Pequots and to sort out the Pequots' problems with the Narragansetts. In return, the Pequots would surrender the killers of John Stone and pay the hefty sum of 400 fathoms of wampum and 70 beaver and otter skins as tribute. The value of the tribute equaled 250 pounds sterling at the time, which was slightly less than half of the total property taxes levied by Massachusetts on its entire population in 1634.
That is a great economic history.
Little wonder the Pequot diplomats in Boston indicated they themselves couldn't agree to such terms. A payment of 400 fathoms might be appropriate if Massachusetts was offering to defend the Pequots if they were attacked, but this guarantee was decidedly not part of the proposed deal. The Pequot emissaries agreed to present the offer to Sassacus, their new chief sachem, upon their return home, and in time he would respond. No matter its exact value, the tribute demanded was sufficiently draconian to amount to extortion. The Puritan authorities were probably well aware that tribute could not be paid in full under the best of circumstances, and the requirement for turning over the killers of Captain John Stone was surely unreasonable. The Pequot emissaries had been completely straight with the Massachusetts authorities concerning their mistaking Stone for a Dutchman.
They're very clearly looking for a war here. I want to play a little bit of a clip by Stephen Crowder. Now, I noticed this when I was doing the research for this, and it's very relevant. So he did a video about how he's upset that people call Columbus Day Indigenous Peoples Day for PragerU, which is a tax-deductible far-right history whitewashing operation. And here's a little bit from this clip.
Thanksgiving, Independence Day, Memorial Day. Holidays are a great time to riddle Americans with needless oppressive guilt. But the one that stands head and shoulders above the rest is Columbus Day. The day where progressives indoctrinate your children into believing Columbus to be Satan incarnate, the USA to be his evil spawn, and the Native Americans to be pacifists.
Now, I don't want to be the fallacy police. I don't think identifying fallacies is the most important thing in an argument, but we can easily see that that is a straw man. I'm not going to be arguing that Christopher Columbus is, Satan's spawn or whatever. I do think that calling him a great navigator, as Crowder does in that video, is a pretty egregious violation of historical truth in the sense that Columbus thought the world was about 20% smaller than it in fact is, and that gave him the confidence that he thought he could cross the Atlantic to what he thought would be Asia. And so luck and stupidity and obstinacy were the qualities that Columbus should be known for among actual genocidal attitudes. But let's go a bit further, because the defensiveness by the right to have a realistic understanding of what our history is, that going into history becomes oppressive, is something that I think needs to be countered and I think drawn, and it needs to be drawn out a little bit more. They have this pose that they're the grown-ups that don't want to wallow in guilt and just want to look at history for what it is objectionably, because you need to balance the Puritans' sins with the barbarism of the Native Americans. And there's an assumption that if you look at history, an assumption or an implication by Crowder's tone here, that if you look at history, the scales will balance in that regard. And he says something very funny here, and I think very indicative of a sort of fundamentalist approach of conservatives and people in the right, with the way they approach, whether it's a fundamental reading of the Constitution or the Bible or their favorite race scientist, when really you have to understand the social relationships around those documents. But here's Stephen Crowder for PragerU talking about history.
Your professor probably has taught you the tale of Columbus as a villain, usually as a starting off point to indict the United States as a whole, often relying on a few key myths and some pivotal lies by omission.
Mm.
So, to start with, I'll bet that you probably believe Columbus and other European settlers to simply have committed mass genocide against Native Americans, sorry, indigenous. But here's the truth. While there were many examples of brutal warfare between Europeans and Native Americans, neither side actually committed genocide. In fact, there was never an outright policy of Indian extermination.
Now that is very, very funny, that there was never an outright policy of Indian extermination. If you're aware of what happens to so quote-unquote policies in the earlier colonial era. I want to go back to God, War, and Providence for a great section on Winthrop. And we have to understand our sources for a lot of these eras come from the quote-unquote founding fathers. They were the ones who had the resources to have, I mean, not only pens and pencils and paper, but also the luxury of being able to sit down and write their thoughts out. Here is this a great section on how that influences history.
As we shall see, there are compelling reasons to believe that Winthrop's seemingly judicious, well-crafted accounts of disputes between Puritans and Indians are peppered with distortions and curious omissions, especially in incidents where Indians put forward compelling defenses of their own sovereignty and autonomy. Unfortunately, every student of Puritan-Indian relations trying to find his bearings must rely heavily on Winthrop's writings, for in a great many cases, his account of a given dispute or event is the only one we have. The first scholar to bring this uncomfortable issue widely into the light was Francis Jennings in his provocative book, The Invasion of America, Indians, Colonialism, and the Cant of Conquest, published in 1975. Professor Jennings has some crucially important things to say about Winthrop's journal, widely recognized as the quasi-official history of the early years of Massachusetts Bay Colony. An unbeliever could say that it presented history with a slant. An investigator may add that it is curiously selective and that the documents concerning Indian relations interpreted by Winthrop have a high mortality rate. Especially as regards Indian affairs, his interpretations have to be accepted in lieu of the prime sources, that is, the actual texts of agreements, because of the latter's disappearance. In the tons of paper squirreled away by Winthrop and his descendants, the only text of an Indian treaty surviving his lifetime is the 1645 treaty with the Narragansetts. The process of natural selection by which the other treaties became unfit to survive must be a matter of speculation, but one can say with confidence that the interpretations provided in Winthrop's journal are unlikely to be accurate representations of the vanished texts. All this sounds like innuendo, so let it be said forthrightly. Winthrop probably rewrote the substance of Indian treaties to meet the Puritans' political and ideological needs, and then he or a devoted descendant destroyed the originals. No one can prove that Jennings is correct, but for two reasons his thesis bears keeping in mind in understanding the struggle between the Narragansetts and the Puritans. First, many contemporary historians and other scholars who have sought to recover the Indian side of the story through the use of archaeological and anthropological evidence believe Jennings's assessment is largely correct. And second, Jennings's thesis goes far in explaining quite a number of otherwise inexplicable actions and decisions.
So yeah, it turns out that maybe the official documents as passed down by the families of these powerful people might not be the best place to look for evidence of atrocities. Crowder goes on to the popular blame smallpox defense, which is responsible for the most deaths, but that doesn't preclude subsequent genocides. The pattern is basically 10 to 20 years before colonists get to a place, traders have been there and those microbes are starting to infect people and kill them. And that precedes the actual demographic force of the Europeans. But then those tribes are never given the opportunity to grow back again because they're weakened and then taken over. And so Crowder makes a claim here, rather than just sitting on that, well, most were killed not by genocide but by smallpox, he goes on to say that none were killed by genocide in war. Here we go.
As far as genocide by violence, you can look at any historical account of even the most one-sided battles and find that they were still just that. Battles!
How about we look at the very first battle, the first big battle, so-called, between New England and the Native Americans. And let's look to see if this looks like a genocide or not. All right, so now let's go to a different documentary that's also on YouTube, a History Channel documentary called Massacre at Mystic, for how this started off.
By 1637, the tensions in New England between the English settlers and the Pequot tribe were about to erupt into armed conflict. In May of that year, the Puritan leaders decided they must take bold action.
The decision to attack the Pequots was predetermined and was well calculated.
The English authorities in Plymouth and in Boston and in Connecticut intended to make an example of the Pequots. The attack was planned by the English to be a massacre. The English purposely sailed their ships by Pequot country to let the Pequots think that they were sailing away.
The English secretly landed in territory controlled by the Narragansett tribe, then marched overland toward Pequot country. Along the way, they picked up several hundred native allies from the Narragansett and Mohegan tribes.
It's surprising that you have Indians who will ally with the English against other Indian groups. That's one thing that people often don't know about these conflicts. We think that it's Indians pitted against Europeans, but it's much more complicated than that.
The Pequot relationship with the neighboring tribes is very complex. Some tribes they were at war with, some they were allied with, some they subjugated.
Prior to the attack on the Pequots, the leader of the Narragansett forces had told them that he would like for them to spare their women and children as Indian people usually did in their warfare.
The English obviously agreed to this, or they wouldn't have gotten the participation of the Narragansetts and Mohegans.
Traditional Native warfare was very different than what you see in the Pequot War. Indian people, Mohegan Indian people, Narragansett people, none of them had any idea what they were getting into.
May 26, 1637. In almost complete darkness, just before dawn, the English forces and their native allies, commanded by John Underhill and John Mason, quietly prepared to attack the Pequot fort at Mystic. Inside, hundreds of men, women, and children lay sleeping, about one-third of the entire Pequot tribe.
You had a circular palisade, a wall, that was built by tree stumps, laid in a circle and pointing upwards and sharpened at the top. And that had two entrances at each side of the circle, where the walls kind of overlapped each other, and there'd be just a space, you know, wide enough for a person to get through.
The English troops rose, and they commended themselves to God. And then they moved toward this palisaded fort. What they counted on more than anything was the element of surprise. If they could get in without being detected, they could achieve their goal of killing the inhabitants and taking away whatever spoils there were for themselves.
This dog barking is a historically accurate touch there.
Mason divided the forces up and they went to the two entrances and they found that the Indians had covered them with brush. They pulled the brush out of the way and they went inside and started entering wigwams and slashing whatever was there. What was there, of course, were women and children and men.
They met with very stiff resistance from the Pequot warriors. John Mason felt that the resistance was too fierce. And he realized that they could not kill everybody by hand-to-hand fighting.
So he ran inside, and he got a torch out of one of the fires, and he came out and he yelled, "We must burn them!"
The English intent was not originally to burn the fort, because they wanted to save the plunder.
Especially the corn.
But Underhill and Mason were professional soldiers. They must have had a plan B. And that plan was to set fire to the fort, retreat outside the fort to prevent anyone from escaping.
The Englishmen ran outside, and the Indians had a choice to make. Stay and die a death under fire, or try to get out. those that tried to get out were either killed by the English, and if they got through that line behind them, there was a line of Mohicans who finished the rest off. It was horrible.
The English themselves described this battle in very frightening terms. The destruction, the burning, the killing. There were so many people lying on the ground, Pequot men, women, and children, that the English couldn't even walk without stepping on bodies.
The scene was so shocking that even some of the English began to ask if, as Christians, they ought to show some mercy. But Captain Underhill pointed to the Old Testament and said that God wanted those who were sinners, heathen, to suffer, he said, the terriblest death that may be, and that the innocent needed to suffer along with the guilty.
Even though the Narragansett and Mohegan had no love lost for the Pequots, they were absolutely shocked by the brutality that the English displayed to attack elderly men and women, or women and children, women with nursing children. They went up and threw their hands up and said, "Mach it, mach it, it's too much." They were distraught is not too strong a word.
Hundreds of people lay dead. And it was a moment that changed everything for the English and the Indians. Not just for that day, but from that day forward. The possibilities of trust and cooperation that had been there at the beginning went up in smoke. The massacre at Mystic took only 1 hour. 1 hour to kill hundreds and hundreds of Pequot men, women, and children. But it was far from over, as tribe members who were living nearby were about to find out.
After the massacre, the other Pequot villages attempted to come to their rescue.
They saw the smoke, and they immediately started to come towards the fort to see what had happened, because they knew their women and children were there.
But they were too late.
It was overwhelming for them. You have to understand that this is a moment for the native people that was beyond their comprehension. They never fought wars to wipe out another group.
Within a few weeks after the Mystic Massacre, the English began a systematic attempt to hunt down.
Now let's bring our buddy Stephen Crowder back here.
As far as genocide by violence, you can look at any historical account of even the most one-sided battles and find that they were still just that, battles.
So yeah, as we just saw, not exactly a battle. Many of the warriors weren't even in the village when it was burned. In fact, Sassacus, the Pequot chief, had to view it from a distance away and with a bunch of the warriors. But let's get into the explicitly genocidal aftermath, and this is back at the Massacre at Mystic documentary.
They never fought wars to wipe out another group.
Within a few weeks after the Mystic Massacre, the English began a systematic attempt to hunt down all the surviving Pequots. They wanted to eliminate Pequot leadership. They wanted to make sure that the Pequots would never again come together and be a threat to them.
John Mason summed up the aftermath of the Mystic Massacre in this way. Thus did the Lord scatter his enemies with his strong arm. The Pequots now became a prey to all Indians. Happy were they that could bring in their heads to the English, of which there came almost daily to Windsor or Hartford.
We estimate that about 1,500 Pequots were killed or sold into slavery after the Mystic Massacre.
Many Pequot Indians are sold to other English colonies outside of New England, so sold to Bermuda or sold to the Caribbean islands. That way they can never come back to pose a problem for the English ever again.
The Treaty of Hartford officially ended the Pequot War with a set of provisions that are about as bad as provisions can get. Men who had fought against the English in the Pequot War had already been killed or sold into slavery. Women and children who survived were given as servants to the Mohegans or to the Narragansetts. What you have embodied in the Treaty of Hartford is literally a statement espousing genocide.
It was a cultural genocide as well. the tribe's name, its language, all of those were outlawed by this treaty.
Officially speaking, the Pequot Indians no longer existed.
The Pequot encounters with the colonials are going to reverberate and set the stage. The massacre at Mystic would be repeated.
Even the Narragansetts, who had allied with the English during the massacre at Mystic, were not safe. Just 40 years later, in one battle of what became known as King Philip's War, the Narragansetts were similarly massacred, their survivors sold into slavery.
It was repeated over and over again. Either you sold the land, you moved off the land, or we would push you off the land.
The mistrust that could lead to incredible violence continued for 250 years. It marched across the country in battle after battle, dispossession after dispossession.
The massacre at Mystic Fort shaped the rest of our history.
Victory over the Indians was seen as a triumph of light over darkness, civilization over savagery. And that became, for many generations, our nation's central historical myth.
And there you have it. And I want to go right now to play an extended section of how one of my favorite books, another one you should pick up, American Colonies by Alan Taylor, described this Pequot War as well.
The first major conflict between the New English and the Indians erupted in 1636. Determined to extend their authority into the Mystic River Valley of southeastern Connecticut, the colonial leaders demanded that the resident Pequot pay a heavy tribute in wampum, give up several of their children as hostages, and surrender suspects accused of killing a traitor. Rebuffed, the Connecticut, Plymouth, and Massachusetts colonies declared war and pressured the Narragansett and Mohegan peoples to help fight the Pequot. The Narragansett and Mohegan consented in part from long rivalry with the Pequot and in part from a preference for joining the side likely to win. As their reward, the Indian allies meant to strengthen their numbers with Pequot prisoners. In May 1637, Narragansett and Mohegan warriors guided the Puritan forces deep into the Pequot territory to surprise a palisaded village beside the Mystic River. The village contained about 70 wigwams and 400 inhabitants, mostly women, children, and old men. Commanded by Captain John Mason and Captain John Underhill, the New English and their Indian allies surrounded the sleeping village and set it ablaze shortly before dawn. The Pequot died either in the flames or in flight from the inferno as they ran into the gunfire and onto the swords of their enemies. Captain Mason exulted, "God was above them who laughed his enemies and the enemies of his people to scorn, making them as a fiery oven and filling the place with dead bodies." Only about 5 inhabitants survived by breaking through the surrounding circle of their enemies. The indiscriminate slaughter contradicted Indian custom and shocked the Narragansett and Mohegan allies, who had expected to capture and adopt the women and children. They bitterly complained that the New English mode of war was too furious and slays too many people. A veteran of warfare in Europe, Captain Underhill dismissed the more limited Indian mode of war as more for pastime than to conquer and subdue enemies. He sarcastically noted that they might fight for 7 years and not kill 7 men. If so, on a single day, Underhill helped to destroy the equivalent of nearly 400 years of Indian warfare. Many Puritans in England also criticized the New English for overkill. Feeling defensive, leading colonists insisted that they had done God's bidding. Captain Underhill conceded, "It may be demanded, why should you be so furious, as some have said? Should not Christians have more mercy and compassion?" But he retorted, "Sometimes the scripture declareth that women and children must perish with their parents. We had sufficient light from the word of God for our proceedings." Similarly, Governor William Bradford recalled, "It was a fearful sight to see them thus frying in the fire and the streams of blood quenching the same, and horrible was the stink and scent thereof. But the victory seemed a sweet sacrifice, and they gave the praise thereof to God who had wrought so wonderfully for them, thus to enclose their enemies in their hands, and given them so speedy a victory over so proud and insulting an enemy." Regarding war as a test of their godliness, the Puritans interpreted their especially bloody victory as compelling proof that God had found them worthy. During the rest of 1637, mop-up expeditions killed or captured most of the remaining Pequot. The victors executed some captives and enslaved others for their own use or for profitable sale in the West Indies. But they bartered most of their captives, principally women and children, to their native allies in return for wampum. Only about half of the 3,000 pre-war Pequot survived the war, almost all as subjects of the Mohegan or Narragansett. The colonial leaders formally declared the Pequot nation dissolved. A generation later, however, the colonial leaders decided to weaken the Narragansett by encouraging the Pequot to secede and reconstitute themselves on part of their former homeland, but in strict subordination to Connecticut. In the next big war, in 1675 and 76, the Pequot helped the colonists to attack the Narragansett. Lacking a collective identity as Indians, the natives continued to think of themselves as members of particular bands and tribes, which rendered them all vulnerable to colonial manipulation and domination. Despite the colonists' many contentions over lands, boundaries, and theology, the New English fundamentally considered themselves a common people sharply distinguished from all Indians. When push came to shove, colonists usually set aside their squabbles to unite in war against Indians. Noting the power of colonial solidarity, in 1642 the Narragansett sachem Miantonomi urged a radical new idea, a common Indian identity in union against the invaders. He argued, "For so are we all Indians as the English are, and say brother to one another, so must we be one as they are, otherwise we shall all be gone shortly." But Miantonomi's pan-Indian proposal foundered against the short-term interest of rival sachems who curried favor with the powerful New English. In particular, the opportunistic Mohegan sachem Uncas built the power of his relatively small band by assisting the colonists. When the Puritans first settled in the Connecticut Valley, the Mohegan were paying tribute to the Pequot. To secure Mohegan independence, Uncas helped the colonists to smash the Pequot in 1637.
That's Alan Taylor again with In American Colonies. You look at the very first battle, or war, between colonists and Indian or an indigenous group, and you have a textbook genocide, complete with expunging of history of that group. As I said earlier, the Pequot River is renamed the Thames River. Here is one of the most egregious parts of that Stephen Crowder documentary, which is the very end.
Thank you for watching this video. To help keep PragerU videos free, please consider making a tax-deductible donation.
Now, the Literary Hangover is not tax-deductible, but we do have 122 patrons right now, and I'm really, really thankful to everybody who has contributed. I can't tell you how exciting it is to be growing this into what I think can be the best podcast in this sort of field. I want to do more of these. I apologize if this was a bit of a all-over-the-place journey through the Pequot War. I'm still learning how to organize this stuff better. But I want to thank everybody for joining me. Thanks very much, everybody. We'll be back in a couple weeks.